Sit down and buckle up. It's time for the Pirate Monk Podcast.
Welcome to another episode of the Pirate Monk Podcast. Oh boy, I can't believe it. Once again, Aaron, you and I are in the same virtual room about to have a great conversation. Even though we are in separate states, I'm still down here in Florida. You're up there in Tennessee.
I want to make a Florida joke. I just don't actually know any. but I feel like there should be one. So listeners, insert your own Florida joke right there.
A Florida man joke. Yeah. I'm a little bit sore, but in a good way. My son and I are doing this rucking thing, you know, wearing the weighted vest.
What's a ruck? A rucking thing? Hell is that? Yeah.
This is a kind of low impact aerobic exercise. My son is a runner. He does ultra marathons. He would like me to be a runner. There's no way in hell I'm going to be a runner.
Yeah, no, you're not.
So, but what we do is we put on these weighted vests that make us look like we're on a SWAT team, and we walk. And we did a couple miles on the beach today, and I'm feeling it, but in a good way.
Man, the vests and the beach, that is way harder than your usual just chatting with a guy each day for 3 miles. That's intense.
Yeah.
Is he doing this just to be with you, or is he concerned about you? What's his motivation? What's happening in Daniel's head?
Oh, he knows that I go for walks with guys, and he likes to be in on it. We're having great conversations. Well, the nice thing about rucking is you're not breathless. You can still talk, but you're not rucking, strolling.
I don't know why everything that gets given a name annoys me so much. Like, just call it, I put a weighted vest on. No, it's got to be rucking. Now I'm against it. I'm against rucking. I'm just putting it out there. It annoys me now. I know, it's me. It's me. It's not rucking. It's not you. It's not Daniel. It's me.
One of the things I'm going to have to decide is whether I will wear the weighted vest on April 21st for the Samson Society Recovery Marathon.
Okay, so there is a day coming up where I expect you to be rucking. You rucking walker. Okay. Language is going to get worse in this podcast, by the way. But for now, it's just you rucking walker.
Okay, yeah.
So what is this? What's this marathon?
Well, it's a lot of things. It is a fundraiser for Samson House. But more than that, here is an opportunity for guys and girls. This is not going to be limited to guys go through all 12 of the 12 steps in a day. And at the same time, on that same day, either walk or run a half marathon or a full marathon. I'll go half marathon. There's no way that by April 21st, I'm going to be ready to do a full marathon, but half marathon.
I'll do a full marathon. What's that? 3 miles?
Right.
No, what? It's not.
So the idea is, here's the idea. There is a 10 minute presentation on the step.
Each of the 12 steps.
Right. At the top of the hour, a 10 minute presentation. And then for the first hour, you run or walk for 2 miles if you're doing a half marathon, or 4 miles if you're doing a full marathon. That's really to kick it off.
And then these 10-minute things, like I've seen people who are Samson buddies, but I've also seen, what are some of the other people? We've got Wendell Moss, who blew my mind when he was on.
So here are the Andrew here are the presenters. Bowman. We have a separate presenter for each step. Somebody who's really can speak with some expertise at that step. And they include Michael John Cusick, Drew Boa, Adam Young, Roan Hunter, Jim Kress, Adam Bauman, Ian Cron, Wendell Moss, KK Ray, our own Justin Schwind, and Tom Mocha and myself.
That's pretty insane. I mean, these are some of our favorite podcast guests and people that have come out and spoken at our retreats. That's pretty cool. So where do people sign up for this very bizarre? I mean, I think it's bizarre and I think it's cool, but I hope these rucking people ruck their rucking asses off. I don't know. I'm gonna use this a lot now.
Well, there will be a link in the next issue of the No Bull Briefing. If you don't get the No Bull Briefing or it's not handy when you hear this episode air, here's the URL I have. It's recoverymarathon.zohobackstage.com.
How do you spell Zoho? Well, look, we'll put it in the show notes.
That's a good idea.
That'll be a better idea. Nobody's going to know how to spell Zoho. But also, this is a great kickoff in late June. When we come back from England a couple weeks later, Carver Brown is coming to the harbor. So the harbor will be done by then. It better be done by then or else it'll be an awkward retreat. But Carver Brown, and you can look him up. I can't remember which episode he was on. I could look it up right now, but I'm not gonna. He's an old friend of Nate's and has been a part of 12-step recovery for so long. And Nate had talked about doing a 12-step basically intensive for one weekend, right? With one of the early, what was the guy you did it with?
I did it with Dick B. I mean, way back. Okay.
Yeah.
And Carver Brown has led thousands of people through the 12 steps.
Yeah. And he took that and has also been doing that for decades, where you spend one weekend and you basically just go through the 12 steps. And he does this all over the country all the time. And he's going to come and we're going to have 15 guys. It's going to be like 15 spots. For guys that say, okay, I either want to re-engage this or engage this for the first time and hit all 12 steps in 48 hours at the Samson Harbor. It's going to be June 28th through the 30th. And we're going to get you more information in the near future. But man, if you did the marathon and then hit that, you'd just be, I mean, that would be amazing.
You know what? You'd probably at that point be fixed, don't you think?
I think you would never, ever.
You'd probably graduate.
Yeah, you'd graduate from recovery.
Yeah, you would be relapse proof. And you'd get your, successful Pharisee certificate.
You could just memorize Bible verses from then on.
All right. Well, you know what? We have a guest coming up who has a different perspective, I think, on the process of sanctification, its purpose, and its progress. It's going to be a worthwhile conversation for you to listen to when we return on the Pirate Monk Podcast. We in the Samson Society love our meetings, and we love what happens between the meetings in friendships. We know that recovery requires relationship, that the opposite of addiction is connection. And we've also learned that there are times when we've plateaued in our recovery, or if we've suffered a setback, when it really helps to make a connection outside the meeting with an expert coach or therapist. And we've featured a lot of those people on this podcast, including the Hunters, Roan and Roe and Eva Hunter of LifeWorks Counseling in Madison, Mississippi. The Hunters are thoroughly Christian and fully trained, certified sex addiction therapists. They and their staff work with individuals and with couples dealing with addiction and with betrayal trauma. And you don't have to live in Mississippi to see them. You can actually reach them at lifeworks.ms and connect with them through telehealth. And you may not need to commit to a long-term connection with them. Maybe what you need is to attend one of the several intensives that they run each year for the Samson Society. To reach the hunters at LifeWorks, simply go to lifeworks.ms or give them a phone call at 601-790-0583. That number again, 601-790-0583. LifeWorks Counseling is a sponsor of the Pirate Monk Podcast. Welcome back to the Pirate Monk Podcast. Hey, Aaron, I just finished, actually, I'm still working on a book that has really grabbed me. I want to read an excerpt from the book.
Wait, I first have to ask, where did it grab you? I mean, that seems relevant and important.
Okay. All right.
Your heartstrings? You could just say yes, your heartstrings.
Okay. It was my heartstrings. Okay. Here we go. The history of this world and of our lives proves that we humans have a huge capacity for screwing up, a natural tendency towards self-defeating behavior, what Sigmund Freud called thanatos, a universal and innate death drive. In one of Edgar Allan Poe's short stories, The Imp of the Perverse, he explores our self-destructive impulses and argues that knowing something is dangerous and wrong can be the one unconquerable force that makes us want to do it. How screwed up is that? Echoes of the Apostle Paul's words that the law stirs up sin. We make a habit of running blindfolded on the treadmill, juggling knives. In his book Unapologetic, Francis Spufford simply calls it HPTFTU, the human propensity to fuck things up. Quote, what we're talking about here is not just our tendency to lurch and stumble and screw up by accident, our passive role as agents of entropy. It's our active inclination to break stuff. Stuff here including moods, promises, relationships we care about, our own well-being and other people's, as well as material objects whose high-gloss positivity seems to invite a big fat scratch. So, while repeated ruinous behavior is foolish, hurtful, and inexcusable, it shouldn't be shocking. It shouldn't surprise us when fallen people keep falling down and broken people keep breaking things. We should expect sinners to sin. Hell, even St. Paul lamented that the things he knew he shouldn't do, he kept on doing. See Romans 7. None of this, by the way, is an excuse for doing destructive stuff. But it does explain why we foolishly keep on doing destructive stuff again and again and again. My devastating actions were catastrophic for me and many others, and there's no justification for my actions. I was responsible to make better choices, and I willfully ignored that responsibility, and people I love very much were hurt. Those lines come from a book soon to be released. Yeah.
Well, I want to just see how long we can talk about this book and this author without inviting for the conversation. Let's just keep that rolling. This is coming from a memoir that is trying to provide explanation without excuses. We're going to get into that a little bit more. But man, that's some deep. Yeah. Like let's pretend that the author is not sitting here for a moment, and I want to hear why you chose that excerpt, Nate. What did it mean to you?
Well, I mean, I love it because I think that the author, in a very succinct but powerful way, describes this ongoing drive toward doing stupid stuff.
The death drive, man.
Yeah.
The death drive. Yeah.
Well, the book, by the way, is Carnage and Grace, soon to be released. It comes out on March 5th, and the author is none other than our good friend Tullian Tavidian, who is joining us today.
Oh, hey, Tullian. Man, welcome, Tullian. You get to talk.
Thank you, guys. Yeah, I was sitting here thinking, what excerpt is he going to read? And I remember where I was and what I was thinking when I wrote those paragraphs.
Tell us.
Well, I was sitting on my couch. It was late at night. I had been reading some articles and trying to figure out how can I explain recidivist behavior to people who think that human beings are just getting better and better and wiser as the days go by. Because when I crashed and burned nearly 10 years ago, I thought I was beyond the kind of mistakes that I had made. And I realized, of course, that I wasn't. And I think part of recovery is realizing that you're never on the other side. You know, that recovery is a lifelong process because the human condition is so broken and twisted, which requires God's grace on a moment by moment basis to sustain us. In fact, a lot of the people that I know who are in recovery, who have stayed sober from whatever their, you know, DOC was, whether it was drugs, alcohol, sex addiction, whatever, the people that I know who have stayed sober are people who realize that they are always one choice away from going back to hell. And the people that I know who have been in recovery, who think that they're on the other side of it now, that they've beat it and that it's behind them, almost always relapse. And they're shocked when they do. It was a way to sort of look back at what some historians and writers and thinkers had to say about the human condition. And Freud, of course, was not a Christian. Edgar Allan Poe, as far as we know, was not a Christian. It's just interesting that you don't have to be a Christian to have a low anthropology. In fact, most Christians have a high anthropology, sadly. But people who are observant throughout history have recognized that we have a human propensity to break things.
So I've got two questions for you. Two questions. The first is, I don't remember the first time you were on this show. Nate, do you remember what year that was? Tolian, do you remember?
I don't know. We should have researched it before we started recording.
Yes, you should have. Shame on you guys. Jeez,
yeah, what kind of operation are you running? Are you here feeling a Nate? I'm not, but I'm working on it.
I think the first time I came on with you guys was 2021, and then I think I came on again last year, in 2022, either 2022 or early 2023. I can't remember.
Okay. So I feel like I have seen such a difference in you in the first interview to the second interview to reading this book. That feels like, I mean, it's kind of bizarre because I'm not in the mood to judge people one way or the other, but I feel like I've seen so much growth. Now that sounds patronizing, but I feel like I've felt that in conversations with you. Do you feel that in yourself, or am I just being weird?
Well, first of all,
you can tell me that.
After the second interview, you sent me a very kind and well articulated email that I still have, and you were saying those very things. And of course, you know, I'm in my own skin, I'm in my own head. You know, you stare at yourself in the mirror every day. You don't recognize the changes that happen like other people can, especially people at a distance. But I mean, listen, I take this recovery business seriously. And what I mean by that is I think my crash and burn that happened very publicly gives you, and this is why it's a gift. In many ways, it's a gift. And by saying it's a gift, I'm not trying to minimize what I did or minimize the hurt I caused, but it is a gift in the sense that consequences awaken you and it increases your level of self-awareness. It just does. And you realize that you are far more capable of screwing things up than you ever thought. And with that comes some level of humility or humiliation, whatever way you want to put it. I mean, humiliation does have the power to humble you. And I do think, and I say this at the end of the book in the epilogue, which is my favorite section of the book, but I talk about what the people around me, the people closest to me who have observed me and have witnessed me over the last 9 years or so, what they say about me in terms of, you know, just what crashing and burning and bottoming out can do in the hands of a very gracious God. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that there's now, listen, I've got, you know, my family, my kids, my wife have a huge part to play in that. I have been loved really, really well when I didn't deserve it, really well, by the people that I hurt the most. And I think that also has an effect on you. It just sort of softens you, you know, it sort of smooths off some of the rough edges. So yeah, I mean, thank you for saying that. And I like to believe that there's truth to it. I hope there is to some degree, but again, you know, it's not necessarily something I can see.
Yeah. Well, that's why I was curious. And that brings me to question two, which is what led you to feel like, I need to write this down. I need to write a memoir. Are we calling it memoir? Are we leaving the R?
I don't know. The way it sounds so much more fancy when you say memoir.
Yeah, I like that. So what brought you to write this?
This book started and stopped many times over the years. And I'm a writer. It's one of the things that I feel summoned and gifted to do. It's part of my DNA. And so whether I'm just taking notes on my phone or writing something to put out there for the public, whether it be on social media or in articles, something like that, writing has always helped me figure out what I think. Always.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
External processor. And part of that external processing happens for me in writing. So I knew that I wanted to write something about my story. I knew that I probably should write something about my story. The timing of it all was the question. And, like I said, it would start and then it would stop and then it would start and then it would stop. And after about four or five times of starting and stopping, I kind of quit. And I think it was wise to quit when I did because I needed more time. I mean, the first time I started putting words on paper, some of which appear in this book, were 6 months after everything blew up. I mean, I wrote, you know, three or four paragraphs, and my thought then was, I'm going to write a book. And that came to a screeching halt, as it should have. I mean, I wasn't far enough away from everything that had happened to have any kind of perspective. And then maybe a year or two later, I started writing some other things. And then a year or two later, started writing some other things.
Can I pause you right now?
Yeah.
Because I feel like everybody who has hit rock bottom, who has entered into recovery, they don't have the thought, I can write a book, because they haven't written books, but they start writing journals, they start writing other things that try to explain themselves. And if 5 years later they read what they wrote six months in or 1 year in, I think they would feel the exact same, even though they never thought it would be a book. Nate? Yes?
I'm not sure I follow what you're saying.
I'm saying, the
same as Tullian?
Yeah, that they're not thinking they're writing a book, but they're writing stuff down, but so much. If they read it 5 or 10 years later, they'd be like, oh my gosh.
That's why this is valuable, because Tullian is putting words to an experience that is a common experience. Now, Tullian's was off the charts. I mean, he got tons of visibility, national, international ministry when he hit the wall. But I'm talking on a weekly basis practically to guys in ministry who have hit the wall. The whole thing has blown up on them. and they don't know how to process it. It's terrifying. They don't know how it's going to end. To see it as a good thing at that point is impossible, which is why I think this book is a great gift to those men and to the people who love them and the people they serve.
And to those guys who are 6 months in, it's not bad that you're trying to grapple with it.
Mm-hmm.
Just know that a year and a half in, 3 years in, 6 years in, it's going to keep changing. And I think that's what I find interesting about this.
Well, and I'll be honest, when I went back in preparation to write this book, when I went back to some of those early things that I wrote, I read those sections out loud to my wife and was like laughing, going, what the hell was I thinking? Like, I would never, ever. A, this is not an accurate representation of the facts, number one.
Spinning
the narrative in my favor, of course.
Yeah, right,
only
sure.
Just enough to make people think I was sorry. But in my heart of hearts, it was all damage control. Okay. Number two, I don't feel that way now. I mean, thank God that I didn't publish a book back then. I mean, I would have regretted it for the rest of my life. You know, and there's no hard or fast rule about how long after you crash and burn, if you do want to write it all out, how long. I think it was beneficial for me to write along the way and go back and read what I had written along the way.
Yeah.
And then be able to see, number one, sort of the growth that had taken place. It gave me some perspective on who I was 6 months after my crash and burn compared to who I am now. It actually, even though I didn't use those things for the book, it did inform some of what I wrote in the book because I was able to further reflect on just how long of a process it is.
There's no rush version. That's kind of my point of bringing it up is if we're going to be talking about grace in the process, we can't despise the 6 month in man.
Correct.
He has to be present even in his delusion.
Yes.
Because there's no way to not be deluded. You can't know what you don't know until you know something different and then look back and say, oh my gosh.
Yes.
And so we can't despise that person because we don't believe that Jesus despises that man in that moment.
That is remarkably said. Seriously. Damn, I wish I would. That should have been included in the book. That sentence right there. Just being, you know, you're exactly right. And, you know, an interesting thing happened as I was writing it. First of all, let me say that, I don't think I've cried more in my entire life as I did during the 18 months I was writing this book. I mean, my wife and daughter can testify because they live with me. I had to revisit some of the darkest, hardest, most painful moments of my life. The sections where I talk about my kids, my three kids, who are all grown adults. They're 29, 27, and 22 now. And they were, you know, at the time, 20, 18, and 13. But the sections that where I talk about telling my kids that I had cheated on their mom and just the destruction that followed and blowing up their world and just how public it was, like Nate mentioned, my family didn't even have a space to grieve this in private. I mean, whenever we turned around, somebody was commenting on it. Someone had an opinion about it. Well, that had an effect on my kids too. Thank God they didn't grow to resent ministry or God or anything like that. Thank God. But I mean, there were some really, really difficult sections to write. And in the process, I discovered that people who I was also hurt during that process. I mean, there were people who I thought were close friends of mine who bailed, you know, when things got bad. Thankfully, there are some remarkable exceptions to that, and I go into that in the book. But people who I really thought were friends bailed. Some of them bailed. I mean, I was hurt too. And I didn't realize, I thought I had worked through a lot of that stuff with those specific people. And I realized in writing the book that I hadn't. And yeah. What was very interesting to me was as I was probably three quarters of the way through, one night I closed my laptop and I looked at my wife who was sitting there and I started crying. And I said, something very strange is happening as I've been writing this last section. And she said, what? And I said, I have an unexplainable level of compassion for people who hurt me. Because I now understand that nobody behaves well in chaos. Everybody's just reacting to what's going on. And I really developed, it's almost like writing the book was, in a sense, the final piece of therapy I needed to finally let go of some resentments I'd been holding on to and didn't realize I was holding on to. But the second thing that was amazing to me and surprising is that I developed a hell of a lot of compassion for myself, the me of that season in life. And, you know, I look back now and I think if that guy were to walk through my front door, jacked up as he is, all I would want to do is hug him and tell him it's going to be okay. And I love you. And people fuck up and make mistakes. And even though yours were, you know, sort of massive, and because it was a massive explosion, shrapnel hit a lot of people. I was surprised by that. I always thought that the appropriate posture that I should have for the person I was is a posture of law. Is sort of like this kid needs to be. He needs to get his ass kicked. He needs to be beat up. He needs to be slapped around. And in writing this book, it's almost like the man I am now felt a tremendous amount of pity for the man that I was then. And that almost sounds controversial.
Okay. I want to hear both of you speak to this because I think this is the hardest part for most of us ground dwellers.
Mm. Yeah.
The process of I'll give you this first. For about a year and a half after I really had to process my own shittiness, I kept remembering this picture in my head, person looking up saying, "I'm not so proud now." And I'm like, I know it's from somewhere. I Googled it, I did everything. It took me over a year and a half to realize it was from the movie The Four Feathers with Heath Ledger, and he had been branded a coward, got four feathers, went off to rescue friends, and someone said he was proud, and then he ended up failing at everything he was trying to save and in bondage in a prison, and he looks up at the same person from there and said, "I'm not so proud now." And that encapsulated two straight years of my life where that was all I could think was, I never thought I was proud because I didn't think I was better than other people, so I'm not proud. Oh, there was arrogance rampant in my life. And so now you come to a place where you're trying to be honest about your own story, which often means kick your own ass. The more you kick your own ass, the more honest you must be being. And I was okay with that because that led me back to stuff that I had not experienced since I was a kid with like religiosity. And then somewhere along the line, maturity is, okay, I can hold the honesty of that with the reality of how I was also hurt. So I can have compassion for me and I can address how other people maybe did hurt me, and that's not an excuse by saying that hurt me, even though it doesn't remove the shittiness of me in that moment. And that is where the complexity is fucked up in the whole reality of healing. And that's what you were talking about, but I want to hear you both talk more about it because I know a lot of guys who have done shitty things who will not address the pain that came within and before and underneath and around it, because they feel like I'm not being honest if I don't just shit on myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. False humility is a real thing. I mean, false humility is a real thing. Self-pity is a real thing. That stuff is real. Mm-hmm. You know, I think some of my, and it wasn't so much that externally I was eating crow, you know, in a sense. It was more internally, I felt it was the right posture to have to think that I was a real scumbag.
Yeah.
And I did some really scumbaggy things that I wouldn't want my sons doing. I wouldn't want my daughter doing. I certainly wouldn't want anyone doing those things to them.
Well, and you never wanted you doing them.
I never wanted me to do them either. Yeah. And so that those things are real. I think for me, it just took time. Part of the process of me softening included me softening toward the man I was.
Yeah.
And it was a very holistic softening that started to happen as I was making my way through the writing of this book. Like I said, I was developing a posture of grace, not only toward those who had hurt me that I didn't realize I was still resenting at some level. But also, I was developing a posture of grace toward myself, the guy that I was. Nate's got, I'm sure, some much wiser things to
Nate,
say.
No. Nate, well, talk to us, Nate, about this this propensity to fall heavily on shitting on oneself, and that means I'm doing it right.
Mm.
But it's right, missing the grace that God gives us and the hurts we experienced.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that's part of our drive for self-justification. The opposite of self-justification is self-punishment, right? So it's my job to establish and defend my own righteousness. And if I fail, then I've got to punish myself. One of my favorite stories is a guy going on one of those rants in a 12-step meeting until somebody mercifully interrupts him and says, "Buddy, would you climb down off the cross? We need the wood."
Mm.
Yeah. And to learn to be as compassionate toward ourselves in our sin as Jesus was, so how unfailingly kind he always was to the sexually broken. While all the Pharisees are reaching around to pick up rocks, Jesus is so gentle.
Gentle and protective.
Mm.
I mean, if we're talking about the woman caught in adultery.
Right.
So gentle and also, but protective.
Yeah. And also but unblinkingly honest about what's going on.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which I mean, what really strikes me is that whole story of him with the woman at the well. You know, that woman who has, you know, she is so, her life is so screwed up that all the women in the village hate her. She has to come by herself to draw water in the middle of the day. All the other women come in the morning when it's cool. She's not ready to face her stuff. She's ready to have a religious argument. And Jesus just says, "Where's your husband?" "Well, I don't have a husband." "You've spoken that's truth. You've been married 5 times, and the guy you're living with now is not your husband." But what is very clear from the way the story goes, he says it in such a way that she does not hear a bit of condemnation in that statement of fact. In fact, it's so gentle and so kind that she runs back to town to say, "Hey, come hear the guy who told me everything I ever did.
Who's going to expose you? Come on, everybody."
Mm-hmm. That's how gently expose he exposes you. Us. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And I think the two go hand in hand in terms of showing compassion to ourselves combined with the courage to be honest about the facts. I don't know if I would have been able to be as honest about everything that happened, who I was, how it led to that, the aftermath of that, if I had not developed some level of compassion and a posture of grace toward that guy. I mean, you know, it sounds like we're minimizing it. We're saying, oh, poor me. That's the furthest thing from the truth. I am looking at the situation both inside me and outside me realistically and going, I know what my reaction has been with my adult kids when they screw up. I just want to hug them and I want to remind them it's going to be okay. I love you. And no matter what you do, I'm not going anywhere because you're mine. You belong to me. And to realize, as Nate said so eloquently, that is always Jesus's posture toward us. So who the hell am I to keep forcing a former me to just eat shit? And everybody, if you do it long enough, everybody might believe that you are repentant. And then that exposes the fact that what we're really trying to do is convince others that we're sorry when maybe we're really not.
Well, okay, so I keep thinking about the guy who's at 6 months. I keep thinking about the Tullian that started writing this at 6 months. And what you're both saying leads me, and you can correct me or expand on it, to think there's no shortcut. If I try to spiritual bypass by grabbing a hold of a Jesus that's like, okay, we're done, well, then I don't go through the process. That there's a process and I can't rush it. Jesus is the same Jesus through the whole process, but I'm going to go through ups and downs in that. Jesus spoke to that woman without changing the story. He gave her the clear story and exposed things, and yet it was gentle enough that didn't drive her away from him. But I feel like through all of this, I'm hearing, okay, just trust that he loves you now. He'll love you in a year and a half from now, 3 years from now. The difference will be how you see this, and don't try to find the answers on your own. Just proof texting Bible verses. Just walk through this process.
You know, I shared this at a conference that Nate and I were just at recently. One of my counselors, very close friend of mine, a mentor of mine by the name of Paul Zoll, he was the guy who walked through the valley of the shadow of death with me. I mean, he didn't blink. He didn't bail. He understood the human condition well enough to know that things typically get worse before they get better. You know, a lot of the Christian community assumes that when someone gets caught, when someone is exposed, that the immediate reaction from the person who's been caught or exposed should be, you know, repent in sackcloth and ashes and, you know, whatever. And I'm like, dude, think Paul was wise enough to know that when we get caught, we spend at least a year trying to cover our tracks, spin the narrative, trying to get around us that we're not as bad as we think we are, that everyone, I mean, he was walking alongside of me every time I would lie to him. Tell him half truths, or, you know, and he knew he expected that. He has a very low anthropology and expects broken people to keep breaking things. So he was, you know, he would walk with me. And as the recovery process started getting deeper and deeper and deeper, as both God and Paul were taking me deeper and deeper and deeper under my surface, I would call him, and during our sessions, I mean, I would vent. I would talk about how hopeless I felt, how desperate I felt, how frustrated I felt. I mean, I would just go on and on and on. And he did something very interesting. He would listen for about 30 minutes or so, however long it took me. And then he would say, Tully, and I have a few thoughts. Can I share them with you? And the reason he asked that question is because he understood that unsolicited advice is always heard as law. We always rebel against it. We always resist it. So he wanted my permission first. And then when I said, of course, you know, Paul, tell me what you think. he would always say after my vent, pouring out, feverishly pouring out my guts, he would say three words to me. He would say, stick with that. And what he meant was there is a lot to learn about yourself and God in the middle of your ruins. Do not look for an exit right now. I know you want relief. I know you want to get to the other side of this. But if you try to get to the other side of this before it's time, you're going to shortchange yourself and everyone else in your life from the things that can happen if you just sit in the ruins for a while, sit in the damage for a while, let it affect you the way it can and the way it should. And, you know, I didn't realize that's what he meant at the time. And it would always kind of frustrate me. Like, what do you mean stick with that? Like, I'm calling you so that you can give me a solution to get me out of the shit that I'm in.
Fix it, Paul.
Right. Oh, and he was just like, no, you need to sit. You need to sit on the bathroom floor for a while. Not because he didn't say that to go, you need to punish yourself
more. No, no.
You're going to miss out on so much of what can happen if you look for a way out too soon.
Nate Larkin of Florida at the moment, speak to us on this. Telling a man who's just spent 30 minutes downloading, if you are a Silas to a person, explain to us how what Tullian just said, that story was that Paul is not a man who steals another man's epiphany, but says, sit with this. Let it have its own process. Describe that in a Silas perspective for those men who feel like they need to give an answer in that moment.
Oh, yeah. There is a temptation to try to give a guy an answer. Ugh. And really the message of the book, this book, and Tullian, you summed it up very, very well on Friday night at the Fallen and Free conference when you really talked about how we don't experience grace until we're really in the ruins. We have to stay in the mess for it to sink deep. You said it so beautifully. By the way, was that session recorded? Is there any way that our listeners can?
Yeah, it was. It will. There are our video audio guy is mastering all the sessions and we'll release them all in about a week or so.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, we have an impulse when we're in the middle of pain to run, run, hide. And if I'm a Silas to a guy and I'm uncomfortable with being around his pain, I may look for an exit just so that I don't have to hurt.
That's really well said. Yeah, very well said.
Yeah. When really the loving thing is sit with him in his pain, and that's going to cost me something. I'm going to have to sit and experience the pain with him. I'm going to have to sit there, and that's hard. And so the temptation is, well, let's find a door out of here.
Oh my gosh, are you just describing the entire book of Job?
Character after
character that says, okay, you're asking these questions, Job. Let me tell you what I know about the universe and God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And how helpful was that?
Yeah, not helpful at all. And you know, I said in the session at the conference that Nate's referring to, I said, you know, we've been told to look up to find God. But in reality, we need to look low, not high. We need to look low. That we tend to think that, you know, what God wants for us is to get out of the hard place we're in rather than discovering God's grace in the hard place. And I just think we're so fixated on fixing ourselves and other people who we deem need fixing, that we're constantly looking for solutions. And God is looking for relationship, connection. And if sitting in the crap of my life and the consequences of what I've done is the place where I will discover God's grace in the deepest way, then God's totally content with me sitting there. In fact, I would even go so far as to say that's what he wants.
Tullian, I look at the Bible and I see all kinds of stories of people having nothing but victory and happiness. I don't
Come
know.
On, I want my best life now.
I don't see stories of people going through hardship and sitting in the ashes and rubble of their lives.
I know. I'm sorry. I got to go back and read the Bible. I haven't read it in a long, long time.
But you are talking about the narrative of the Bible. Every character went through what you described.
There is no
character that God's like, here, these are the people that I'm walking through life with that are experiencing me that didn't walk through that.
Right.
That's the whole narrative, Old Testament, New Testament.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it is. This book, like I said, it was painful, nerve-wracking. My editor, my friend John Blaze, who was my editor, who also helped Brennan Manning write his memoir, All Is Grace. That's why I chose John and sought him out. I told him that in the process of him being my editor, he also became my therapist, because he prompted me with questions that forced me to tell some truths about myself that, quite honestly, I would have been content to leave out. I mean, he kept pushing me and prodding me to go deeper, to tell more, to try to put words to what I had been feeling for so long but could never really articulate. He helped me see that, you know, recovery is not a black and white process. It's gray. It's three steps forward, two steps back, one step forward, three steps back. It's not linear in that regard. And so he really, really helped me understand who I was and who I am. And so, whenever people ask me nowadays, and I get asked this a lot, you know, if I'm on a podcast or I'm being interviewed for something and they say, for the person out there who is where you were before and sees where you are now, what are the things you did to get from where you were to where you are? And my honest response is simply, first of all, it felt like a blur, so I don't know. The second thing is, I can promise you that the only reason I am not where I was and am in a different place now is because God carried me here. And oftentimes he carried me kicking and screaming from one stage to the next. Now, I mean, like I mentioned, he sent Paul's all. He gave me an amazing wife. There were some people that sort of, you know, that closed ranks that were there to help me. God used all that, but make no mistake about it, and all of those same people would say the same thing, it was God and God alone who got me from there to here and will get me from here to wherever I end up. There's no question. And God wasn't just there when everything was good, when everything was rolling, when the successes were piling up. I mean, I feel like I knew God before. I really do. I mean, I feel like I knew him. The one thing that I don't think I knew the way that I know now is his non-blinking friendship. I mean, you know, we tend to think of God in a lot of different ways. He's our savior. He's this. He's our redeemer. But we don't always think of him as a friend. And even if we think of him as a friend, we don't always feel his friendship. I think God allowing people who I thought were my friends to walk out of my life taught me something about friendship. And God befriending me the way he did when I was at my worst taught me something about friendship. So my circles these days are a lot smaller, a lot less impressive. And yet I think as a result, I have friends now, in terms of just the quality of my friendships now, are better than they've ever been. I'm 51 years old and my friendships are better now. And I think he's taught me a little bit about what kind of friend to be.
Well, Tully, and we could end it there, but Nate, can I ask one more question?
All right, go ahead. 30 those seconds.
I can ask it in 30 seconds.
Yeah, that's all I'm asking.
Those that felt like a backhanded comment, but all right. Those people asked about from 2015 to now. When I read the book, you used the word delusional, and I'm very familiar with the word delusional. Mm-hmm. And found myself in places in my life that I'm like, wow, how are you this delusional? What brought you to the place of being delusional enough that none of the now obvious insanity made sense at that time?
Whew, boy, that is a great, great question. I don't think I can answer that in 30 seconds.
No, Nate. You don't have to answer it. Nate only said I had to ask it.
I put the time limit on Aaron, not on you.
Okay. some of it's obvious. Young guy, successful at the top of my game in terms of the industry that I was in. A larger than life personality, big platform, in demand, successful, checking all the boxes that the world gives us to define success, was checking them all. And dude, that stuff just goes to your head. I said this, I think it was this past Sunday, I said that when it comes to the things that matter most, success is far more toxic than failure. Far more
yes.
toxic. Yes. That victory is so much more toxic than defeat when it comes to the things that matter most. I can look back at my life now and go, success, however God may have used the ministry he gave me at that time, and I absolutely believe that he did. I still run into people all the time who talk about books that I wrote before this, sermons that I preached before this, talks that I gave that God really used to minister to them. So I'm not shortchanging what God did then. But I will say that success was not my friend. I mean, it goes back to what does it profit a man to gain a fortune and lose his soul? And then you add to all of those sort of personal achievements, the fact that I came from this, royal family of religion, and inherited one of the most famous pulpits in America at the young age of 36. I mean, I just, and I really thought that I had the character to handle all that stuff. And I was obviously proven wrong. It is very, very difficult to evaluate yourself honestly when you're as successful as I was at that time. It just is. I mean, everybody has something to say. And if you're criticized by one person, three other people come to your defense and justify you. So it's very hard. It's like the emperor who has no clothes. I mean, the people around you benefit from your success. So there are very few people around you telling you the truth about yourself. Very few. When I was critiqued, I had so many more people telling me good things about me that I just sort of brushed that stuff off.
So the movement to delusion was a slow slide.
I say
supported by all of your benefactors.
Yes, the way that I put it is it came on like the slow creep of the tide, not a sudden tidal wave. So you just, you know, I grew up surfing down here in South Florida, and you know, you'd paddle out and you'd sort of identify a landmark to where you were in the water. But the drift can be so strong that if you're not constantly paddling just to stay in the same spot, you drift and you don't even feel it. So all of a sudden you stop paddling because you're tired and you're waiting for a wave and you're sitting on your board, And before you know it, 5 minutes has gone by, 6 minutes, 7 minutes, and you look up and your landmark is a quarter mile down the beach and you didn't even feel yourself drifting. So I think success causes a slow drift that you don't really see until something bad happens, until you're exposed for whatever. So and there's a lot more to it than that. And I go into much more detail in the book, but I look back now and, I was shocked at the time when it happened, but I look back now and realize I shouldn't have been.
Yeah. Well, that's the description of delusion, right?
That's exactly right.
It made sense. Well, how do people get, this is coming out when, Nate? You said
okay. March. The book again is Carnage and Grace by Tully and Tavigian. The official release date is March 5th. Because we're on the inner circle, we actually got an early look. But our
there's only poor, two other people in that circle, by the way. I have a very small inner circle. It's you two, my wife, and kids. That's it.
Wow. Okay. Thanks.
All right. But a great book. And I'm sure it'll be available wherever books are sold.
It will be.
Tullian, thank you so much for joining us on the show. Thank you for having the courage to write. Thank you for writing honestly, humbly, in a way that exalts our Heavenly Father and really proclaims the gospel. It's a beautiful, beautiful illustration of grace.
Well, thank
all right,
you.
And we're gonna wrap this up right now. So Tullian, don't forget your name. You're going to need it.
You're going to stick around for the close.
Yeah, it's happening. We're closing right now.
Okay. All right. So we're wrapping this episode of the Pirate Monk Podcast. Until next week, I'm Nate.
And I'm Aaron.
And I'm Tullian.
Okay. And we are your pals on the Pirate Monk Podcast. Arrgh.
The Pirate Monk Podcast is produced by members of the Samson Society. Send your feedback or questions to piratemonkpodcast@gmail.com. Please give us a 5-star review on iTunes and share the podcast with a friend. For more information, please visit samsonsociety.com.